and good morning. It is 16 minutes after 8 a.m. You're tuned to your community radio station, Raven Radio, KCAW, in Sitka. Joining me in the studio is Esther Kennedy. Esther's the environmental specialist with STERL, and STERL is the Sitka Tribe of Alaska's environmental research lab. Esther spends her days studying phytoplankton and ocean acidification in Sitka Sound. Welcome to Morning Edition, Esther.
Thank you.
Well, today we're talking about phytoplankton. Hopefully you'll come back later and we'll talk about ocean acidification. But it's phytoplankton today. And typically, the STA's Environmental Research Lab focuses on stargavin because that's where people tend to harvest shellfish most frequently. How about we start off by talking about what phytoplankton is?
Well, phytoplankton are essentially microscopic marine plants. And they drift along with the currents, and most of them are single-celled. And much like plants, you know, they grow most in the summer, and they tend to sort of die down in the winter. So, yeah, that's a bit of an oversimplification, but essentially, phytoplankton are just very small plants.
And I think they're also sort of like the foundational resource for energy in the oceans as well.
Am I right about that? Guess I would be... I really am leaving things out if I don't mention that they're the most important oxygen producers in the world. They're really the basis of the marine food chain. And, yeah, are probably taken as a whole the most important organisms on the planet. But also one that people can miss, of course.
Right. So they're really important, but then also they can be harmful to humans as well. And that's one reason why you and your lab study them.
Yeah. Some phytoplankton can make some really potent toxins. And those toxins, since they're at the plankton are at the base of the food chain, can concentrate in animals mostly animals that eat plankton or eat things that eat plankton. So shellfish come to mind in particular because shellfish act like little vacuum cleaners and really concentrate all of the plankton they're eating. If those plankton are toxic, you can very quickly end up with a toxic shellfish. And so that's why we monitor the plankton, because we're concerned about species that produce toxins that lead to, say, paralytic shellfish poisoning or amnesic shellfish poisoning.
So tell me what your week looks like.
Well, once a week or more, I'll go out to Stargavin. I take a net, a very fine mesh net that's about 20 microns wide. The holes are about 20 microns wide, so that's 20 millionths of a liter or of a meter. And I'll tow the net alongside. I actually sample right off of Stargavin Dock. And then once I have my collected bottle of plankton, I'll also gather a few environmental parameters like the temperature, the water temperature, the salinity. And then I take it all back to the lab and I spend a few hours just looking at the sample under a microscope and trying to see what's around and how much of everything there is.
Do you ever actually sample the shellfish as well?
I do. Well, I don't do most of the lab work associated with the shellfish. That honor goes to my coworker, Michael Jamros, who is our lab manager. But typically, because I'm the one going to Stargavin, I'll go collect clams or mussels. Most of the time we're monitoring mussels unless we have a reason to suspect that the other species of clams at Stargavin are getting toxins.
Because mussels are typically the first to concentrate the toxins in their tissues, right?
Mussels are the pigs of the shellfish world. They filter a lot of water. They don't stop feeding no matter what's in the water, so they'll be the first to pick up toxins, and they actually tend to pick up the most toxins. So we can use shellfish, or sorry, not shellfish, we can use mussels as a bit of an... We use plankton as an early warning for the mussels, and we can use mussels as an early warning for, say, the butter clams or the more common cockles and little necks.
So this is why humans just... People should be aware of phytoplankton and have some sort of interest in it, especially if they harvest shellfish. But where does your interest lie? Why is this of interest to you?
A couple of reasons. I mean, in the first place, I just think it's really incredible to see. It's a lot of fun to look at seawater under a microscope and just see how much diversity you can go through life completely missing, because you can't see any of it. But I think it's so important that people have access to shellfish and people have access to subsistence foods, and monitoring phytoplankton is a very easy and good way to get an idea about whether or not it would be safe to consume shellfish.
Well, there were recently in July and maybe the beginning of this month some interesting and very large algal blooms in Sitka Sound, which you heard about. For a lot of that time, you were out doing a really interesting workshop on plankton, which we'll talk about. But what have you heard or learned about these big plankton blooms, which some folks might have noticed, this sort of milky color in the sound, sort of bottle green out further down the road towards the pulp mill area? What have you learned about this?
Well, I was here at the beginning of those blooms, and something that was really nice is we had a lot of people sort of calling us and telling us, hey, the water is weird by my house, what's going on? Which is great for people to do, because frankly, the water was not weird out by Stargavin. So because we're monitoring so far out the road, sometimes we don't necessarily know that the water looks weird at Shotgun Alley unless somebody calls. So really great to hear from people about that. We asked people who were in the area to collect water samples for us. Actually, Floyd Tompkins was someone who did a lot of water collection for us. And when I looked at those water samples, I looked at samples from down by Shotgun Alley where the water was bottle green, no milkiness to it at all. And those samples were just filled with a dinoflagellate, which is a type of phytoplankton that actually can swim, so sort of a swimming plant, called Ceratium. And that's not really a harmful species. It's just not one that produces toxins. It just happened to be one that was doing very, very well at that point in time. And it had reproduced so much that it just gave this water just an incredible green color. I do know further out in the sound where the water was a little bit milky, you had also a bloom of what are called coccolithophores, which are these little single-celled organisms that actually cover themselves in a shell made of calcium carbonate or chalk. And so you can imagine if you have enough of these little organisms that are covered in a chalk shell, that the water would then look a little bit chalky. And coccolithophores are another non-harmful species. But in these big blooms, you do want to make sure during these big blooms, a lot of times, even if they're not producing toxins, you want to keep an eye on them, because sometimes even just having too much of any one thing can be a little bit disruptive to, say, fish in the area or people get concerned. So it's something that you want to keep an eye on, even if it's not something that's a direct threat to human health.
What kind of story do these big blooms tell? Why did this happen?
Well, I think a lot of times it's easy to imagine that blooms are unnatural and that it's something like the ecosystem is out of whack. And I'll come back to that in a second. But at a fundamental level, a bloom is really just, they happen all over the world. They happen at any time the water conditions are just right for a certain species, or typically a certain couple of species. And so you could imagine the water is calm, it's been really sunny, things are warming up, it's summertime, maybe there's an unexpected pulse of nutrients from somewhere, and then just one thing has found its ecological niche and it just gets to take off. And these blooms are typically self-limiting because eventually they run through that nutrient or the conditions change and they'll disperse. There are coccolithophore blooms every year, you know, all over the ocean, and they're really important because it's a big productivity boost. So you can imagine these big blooms, they're producing a lot of oxygen, they're producing a lot of food. So these are natural events. That being said, blooms are becoming more common, and harmful algal blooms in particular are becoming more common, and that is a result of global warming. The warmer the water is, the easier it is for any given phytoplankton species to grow. And so, while these two blooms in Sitka Sound are not atypical, I think it is important for people to realize that there has been an increase in blooms and in harmful algal blooms, and that is related to global warming and changing ocean conditions.
Well, Esther, one final question for you. Two-part question. How can people find out about the status of their shellfish out at Stargavin? And in general, how can they contact you if they have a question about an algal bloom?
For the first part, we really encourage people to either call us at Sterile, or more importantly, we post most of our results online. So the best way really to find up-to-date information is to go to our website, which is cetor.org. That's SEATOR.ORG. That has the most up-to-date information. And then as far as sort of finding out more about algal blooms or giving us a call if something is going, if something seems out of whack, anyone can call me at my office at 907-747-7197, or can call, or can again, like, drop us an email. All of that information is on our website. So
great. Well, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
We've been speaking with Esther Kennedy. Esther's the environmental specialist with Sterile, STA's Environmental Research Lab.